We're going to go on to case number 2 of the morning. This is appeal 2037-99, Susan McKenzie versus the Illinois Department of Transportation. And Ms. Hayes.
Good morning, Patricia Hayes on behalf of Susan McKenzie, appellant plaintiff. Today I'd like to concentrate on two main issues that we've previously briefed. The first one would be whether or not the district court erred in entering summary judgment for the defendant, finding that the plaintiff did not suffer any material adverse employment actions. The second issue that I'd like to address is whether or not the district court erred in striking plaintiff's affidavits that she submitted in opposition to the defendant's motion for summary judgment. Plaintiff Sue McKenzie was an automotive parts warehouser for the Illinois Department of Transportation. In 1990, she filed an action against the Department of Transportation alleging that she had been sexually harassed and retaliated against. In 1995, Judge Mills entered summary judgment in that case for the defendant, and we appealed that case to this court. In this case, we're alleging that after Judge Mills entered summary judgment for the defendant, that the defendant's supervisors, the plaintiff's supervisors, began taking material adverse action against plaintiff Sue McKenzie. Specifically, we've listed several things that were taken or done to Sue McKenzie, and maybe each one of them in and of themselves may not be that severe. The culmination of them taken together really does show that she was subjected to material adverse job actions as a result of her prior case.
Ms. Hayes, if Ms. McKenzie's title and her rate of pay have not changed, and if there is no evidence that an audit is imminent, which might result in such a change, what basis do we have to say that a change in her responsibilities constitutes an adverse employment action?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the fact that all of the automotive duties that she was responsible for have been removed from her, and we have the testimony of Gary Leach, who was the union representative, who says, without a doubt, if there is an audit, her job is going to be reclassified. So she is sitting there just waiting for the other shoe to drop. An audit can be done by an employee, by the union, or the employer. So any one of those three things could happen at any time. And she knows that this is going to happen in the event her job is audited. This happened when her job was reclassified in the early 1980s. Her job went from a clerk position to the automotive parts warehouser based upon a union audit. But the employer could do it depending on, just because it's not imminent today does not mean that it's not going to happen. And this court has previously held that material changes in job duties are adverse actions in and of themselves. So despite the fact that her job title has not changed to date, and the fact that her salary has not changed, does not mean that it is not likely to occur in the future. And at that point, we've lost then the nexus, because the nexus that we have to prove in retaliation claims is that this action followed her coming out for it again. So once the nexus is that once the Seventh Circuit came down with the decision affirming the district court, the employer immediately did this.
But now, what evidence is there that IDOT stated reasons for the change in her responsibilities are pretextual?
They didn't take the action until 1997. The reason they're saying they did this was because of an order that came out in 1995. That's 2 years later. They waited over 2 years before taking action based upon what they're claiming the reason is. That is evidence of pretext. Also, we have the fact that this action came within days of this court affirming the district court in the earlier action. The district, this court affirmed the district court in August, I believe August 10th of 1996. By August 28th, she was sent this notice that she was required to buy back this time that she had used.
But I don't see why that hurts her. And actually, I had a more general question about lots of the things that you're complaining about, which is whether, in your view, an employer has any time window in which it's entitled to adjust various day-to-day problems that arise in the job, whether it's a mistake in how much money is taken for the buyback, or whether it's yes, you do get workers' comp, or no, you don't. I mean, the wheels don't turn instantaneously in these things, and it seemed to me that with respect to many of the points you're arguing, when all was said and done, she was in the position that she was entitled to be in. And I don't see why, whether she has days of leave time versus, versus money in her pocket really matters too much. This regulation allows the state to require you to buy back in that situation.
Well, that, if I could address that, that regulation had been in existence for over 10 years and had never been used before Sue McKenzie. So you have to look at the motivation.
State law? I mean, you know, the state, they're equivalent. You have 8 hours. You either get a day off where you get paid for it later for vacation or sick pay, or you have money. Exactly the same thing.
Well, it's not, Your Honor, because in this case, when she settled a workers' compensation claim for a very small amount of money, it was based upon the unused time that she had taken. And she had to pay her attorney out of that settlement. So, in fact, she was forced to pay back more money than she actually received.
But attorney fees are not something, I mean, we know that they're there in the real world, don't get me wrong, but that's just an incidental cost that we don't take into account.
But that should have been addressed in the workers' comp case on the settlement. If they were going to make her buy back, there is a provision on the settlement contracts to do that. They did not, and they had never done this to any other employee. We submitted sufficient, lots of evidence that in prior cases where people had received lump sum settlements in part due to the payment of TTD where their case had been denied, they had not required them to buy back this time. They were given the option whether or not to buy back the time. And we also here, we have direct evidence from her supervisor, Dick Goodrum, stating that he was going to find a way to discipline her after this case was over. He was a major decision maker in the actions that were taken against her in the handling of her workers' compensation claim and in the decision to buy back, even though he was no longer even involved as her supervisor. He was consulted in the decision to make her buy back this time. She lost money. She lost money during this time, and the garnishment was done unlawfully. They never went to court to get a court order before they unlawfully garnished her wages, and they garnished more money than she was required to buy back.
Which they eventually adjusted. Does a state agency have to obtain such a judgment?
I think the law is that it does. The garnishment statute is quite clear that you need to have a court order in order to, for any employer, to garnish wages from an employee.
I understood the state to be taking issue with that proposition of yours. Perhaps Ms. Welsh will address it.
It's our position that the garnishment was done unlawfully, because there was not a prior court order, and there was no order authorizing them to do that. In addition, like I said, they did withhold or garnish more money than that they should have. But that misses
the point.
I think
the statute is 15 ILCS 405/10.05. It says that the state can garnish as long as it gives prior notification, which she had.
She was given notice with her check, she was given notification, but she was not given any prior notification that they were going to take this action.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal.
Sure. Thank you. Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welch. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Transportation. Your Honors, it's no small irony that the plaintiff is saying that even though, in her opposition to the cost, that we should have won on a motion to dismiss on the legal standard, that now she's saying that we're not entitled to summary judgment on the same legal ground. Your Honors, this is a simple case of failure of proof. The plaintiff simply failed to show that there was any material adverse effect from any of the events that she is discussing on the terms and conditions of her employment. For example, the buyback, as Judge Wood pointed out, this is required under the department rules. Section 303.135 requires that an state employee who gets a workers' comp award and has been given in the interim taken leave days, sick leave days, or vacation days, must pay it back. This is the state law.
But what about Ms. Hayes' argument that it's a state law that's been honored in the breach?
Your Honor, in fact, Mr. Moraro, the person who originally denied her claim, said that in fact this had been done before. That there had been other people had been required to pay this back. Some people had not, apparently, but nevertheless, I mean, I don't think that a Title VII claim can be based on a claim based on an allegation that we're not that she's entitled for us not to follow the law. In addition, as Your Honor pointed out, the 15 ILCS 405/10.5 does require or does permit the comptroller to deduct money from state employees if wages that the state employee owes the state money. There is no court order required. All that's required, as Your Honor noted, is prior notice. And there was a letter sent to the plaintiff on 1/15/97 informing her that this was going to happen. So in fact, the state did, and this is by the comptroller again, also not by the department. So I'm not really certain how the department can be held liable for the garnishment. In addition, there were three, in addition to the buyback and the withholding claims as adverse employment actions, and in fact those were the terms and conditions of her employment under state law, so there was no change in the terms and conditions of her employment. And this, by the way, is what the arbitrator found when the plaintiff filed a grievance on this very issue. So, again, this is not a change in the terms and conditions of her employment.
But neither what about what Judge Robner was asking about, the paring back of her responsibilities on the job?
Mm-hmm.
That seems more substantial to me.
Your Honor, as Judge Robner noted, though, there has been no change in her job title. There has been no change in her salary. She's still employed with the department in the same job. It's with the same job title at the salary, and she's received, I believe, the union upgrades to which she's been due. So again, I mean, this suit was filed in 1998. The fact that it hasn't this imminent change in the terms and conditions of her employment hasn't happened in these 4 years should tell us that the district court was absolutely on the money when it said that her claim that this was going to happen was too speculative.
But don't you think it's a little unrealistic to think that the state would demote her while this litigation is pending? And I think she's trying to say, here's the sword of Damocles hanging over her neck. As soon as this lawsuit's over, the audit will materialize and she will receive, you know, less pay.
Your Honor, the audit could have materialized in 1996 when the first case was over. The audit could have materialized at any point, and it never has.
Is it reasonable to think that IDOT will do an audit at some point?
That I can't tell you, Your Honor. I don't know. I mean, I would assume so, but they did the one in 1995. They also restructured after that. So, I mean, I don't know that any, there's certainly no other audit in the offing. I mean, even Mr. Leach's affidavit said, if an audit is conducted, then this could change. Her job could go away. But there's a lot of cause for speculation there. If there's an audit, maybe her job will go away. She's also a member of the union. The union certainly would not sit still, I would assume, if she has a good union, for her job to disappear. And again, if her job does disappear, then she would have, I would, you know, she conceptually would have a retaliation claim. There's only one other claim, I think, was the life duty denial claim. And again, the plaintiff talks about having a right to life duty, but in fact, the record plainly shows that the life duty is discretionary, and the plaintiff failed to come up with any evidence to rebut the department's evidence that life duty in the plaintiff's case, because she works alone, was simply not doable. That in other cases, when people work together in the same location, one can take over the duties for which the one person is unable to perform. But because the plaintiff worked alone, that simply wasn't possible here.
There seems to be factual disputes between you and the plaintiff with respect to the training that she received on the forklift. Could you address that for a minute?
Sure. I can address that. The plaintiff has pretty much waived that claim on appeal, but there's certainly nothing that would, in the Title VII jurisprudence, that would say that not having enough training for a job is an adverse employment action. I mean, what I understand the plaintiff to have claimed in her complaint and in the district court, although not here, in her brief, is that the training was insufficient. But now she later at her deposition said, "I got enough training. I passed the test. I can operate it competently." So, I mean, I frankly never quite understood what the Title VII claim basis was for that. If the court has no...
I have a question about the cost, because Ms. McKenzie suggests in her brief that some of the costs for which IDOT sought reimbursement were for copies of depositions that IDOT lost. Is that true?
Your Honor, I believe that was the cost that was deducted. We asked for a certain amount of costs. The plaintiff objected. We lowered the cost that we requested. So I believe that diminishment in the final judgment for costs covered that. Yes.
That.
I mean, the plaintiff's real argument, I believe, is that we didn't incorporate all of the depositions into our filings on summary judgment. And in fact, that's not the test. So either by statute or by rule. So,
thank you.
No further questions. We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. As well. Okay. 5 minutes.
If I could address the training issue briefly. What we're claiming is that when the forklift duties were added to Ms. McKenzie's job duties, she was not given any training on how to operate the forklift before she was tested on it. So if that's going to be a material part of her job, which they are claiming, and she's not given any training, she could have failed that and lost her job. And she was injured on it because she wasn't given any training on it.
Right, but I gather the test that you're talking about was one in January, and by April she has in fact passed the test and is fully certified, so it sounds to me like you're worrying about a speculative possibility that never came about.
No, but this was just a part and parcel of what she was going through on a daily basis. This was one thing. If you consider everything that happened to her during this period, this from January to May of 96, maybe each one of these incidents may not be severe, but it was happening to her every single day. Something new was happening. We're not going to let you come back to work like duty. The only restriction she had was no forklift driving, and she was not certified at the time to drive a forklift, and they refused to let her come back to work to do the same job she had been doing prior to January of 1996. There's no basis for them refusing to let her return to work doing the same job she's been doing for 10 years. And in fact, we did present evidence to show that during the time she was off work, no one drove a forklift in her area. So she could have easily returned to work on her limited restrictions of no forklift driving, doing the exact same job, and they refused to let her do that.
Why? Was it a bad bag? She was going to be lifting 80-pound bags? I thought that was part of her job.
No, that was not her The only restriction she had was no forklift driving.
I know, but wasn't part of her ordinary job before she was using the forklift to move items that could weigh up to 80 pounds?
That's correct. And no doctor said she could not do that. That was not part of her restrictions. That was not the basis in which they refused to let her return to work light duty. She never claimed she could not do that. And she was ready and willing and able to go back to work on the limited restriction of no forklift driving. And they subjectively decided, no, we're not going to let her return to work light duty. And surprisingly, the only other person that they also did not let return to work light duty was this Paul Reamer, who also had a prior discrimination claim against the department. And we have the testimony of Jim Ketchum, supervisor who made these decisions, that it's his prerogative, he could do what he wanted, and he, in other circumstances, had allowed other people to return to work light duty. In addition, we have him, when she finally does return to work with a off work, a return to work slip, he sends her home, refuses to honor the return to work slip, and says, I can do whatever I want, your lawyers, your doctors don't run day labor, I do. You know, and he didn't do that to any other person. So this is what she's being subjected to during this entire time on a daily basis. So each one of those things may not be egregious in and of themselves, but when you put them all together, she was in fear of her job. The guy was glaring at her, staying at her home, yelling at her, not letting her return to work light duty, and this was all because he could do it. And we have the testimony of Bill Smith, who even said that these guys get me to do their dirty work for them. On the workers' comp, they get me to do the dirty work for them. He's the one that made the decision that the claim was non-compensable. There was no factual basis given for why the claim was non-compensable. And then, oddly enough, when the case is settled, it is compensable. And still, even after that, they're refusing to pay her the statutory benefits, the SERS benefits, because now they're claiming it's non-compensable again. And the person making that decision is Ketchum's brother-in-law. So we have lots of evidence to show that all these actions were being taken against her for unlawful reasons. The motivation was there. They wanted to discipline her. We have direct evidence that they were going to do it by Dick Goodrum, and they did do it. And we're asking that the court find that these were material adverse job actions and send it back to district court for a trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both Ms. Hayes and Ms. Welsh. And the case will be taken under advisement.